Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello, let's do it again. It's time to learn and improve our American English skills. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Today we bring you political news from Hong Kong. Many people there are hoping for democratic elections, but China says it has the right to say who can run for office. We'll have details. Then, news from the United States. Recently, our highest court heard arguments about the rights of gay and lesbian people to marry. While many states already allow this, the Supreme Court is being asked to make it a right for all Americans, no matter where they live. There you have it, a chance to find out about important events presented at a slower speed for English learners from VOA. Let's get started with part one. Political tensions continue to rise in Hong Kong. Pro-democracy legislators are promising to block China's plan for electoral reform in the territory. The plan calls for electing a city leader from a list of candidates approved by the central government in Beijing. Democracy activists say they will travel throughout Hong Kong over the next several weeks. They want to convince people to support the direct election of Hong Kong's chief executive. Last year, pro-democracy activists shut down parts of the city for months. Earlier this year, Hong Kong's government released a plan for election reform that is almost exactly the same as one proposed by China. It lets people vote for the city's leader, but they can only choose from a list of candidates chosen by a committee loyal to the Chinese central government. Emily Lau is the head of Hong Kong's Democracy Party. She says she and other pro-democracy lawmakers will not permit the plan to be approved.
I think the proposal by the Hong Kong government is not good enough. It does not meet the very basic demands of a genuine democratic elections. So we are going to vote against it. I think many of the pro-democracy members in the Legislative Council are going to vote against it.
After Hong Kong's government released its plan, pro-democracy legislators left the city's parliament building. Most of them wore black shirts with a yellow cross on the front to protest the government's election plans. Two-thirds of the city's legislators must vote for the plan if it is to become law. For that to happen, China and the Hong Kong government would have to convince at least four of the pro-democracy legislators to support the plan. Hong Kong's chief executive, C.Y. Leung, recently spoke to reporters. He warned the city's voters that if their legislators do not support Hong Kong's election plan, it might be a few years before a new plan can become law. But many Hong Kong citizens, especially young people, say if the government's plan becomes law, it would weaken the pro-democracy movement. Pa Sha is a protester.
Well, I think that the best scenario is that it will be vetoed to show that the people of Hong Kong will not be cheated by this fake proposal, fake reform.
The pro-democracy movement has broken up into different groups since hundreds of thousands of demonstrators gathered in Hong Kong last year. Many supporters have left the Federation of Students, which was one of the main organizers of the demonstrations. They disagree with the direction of the movement. Some students say they want to take stronger action. They have protested near Hong Kong's border with mainland China by shouting at and threatening Chinese travelers and shoppers visiting Hong Kong. Although the students and other protesters disagree about methods, The movement appears to have support among people who live in Hong Kong. A recent study of public opinion found that fewer than half of the city's residents support the government's plan. It was least popular among Hong Kong's well-educated young people. The study found 55% of those who have at least a college education oppose the plan. 63% of those between the ages of 18 and 29 oppose it. No large protests have been announced, but demonstrations could begin again if pro-democracy legislators switch their vote and the plan becomes law. Recently, 8 people were arrested during a small pro-democracy protest in the Hong Kong neighborhood of Mong Kok. Television reports showed police using pepper spray and sticks against a crowd of protesters who were trying to block traffic. You are listening to The Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments last month on whether gays and lesbians have the constitutional right to marry. Depending on how the court votes, it could lead to legalization of same-sex marriage across the U.S. Or the court could leave things the way they are. Now each state has the right to decide whether to allow same-sex marriage. Ann Ball explains the situation.
Gays and lesbians can now legally marry in at least 36 states and Washington, D.C. Justice Anthony Kennedy is one of the 9 justices on the nation's highest court. He wrote the court's 3 previous gay rights decisions. All eyes and ears were on Justice Kennedy to see if he would show which way he was leaning on the issue. But he did not tip his hand. 2 years ago, in another case called United States versus Windsor, the country's highest court threw out the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. It said the law was unconstitutional and no longer valid. That meant that the federal government now recognizes same-sex marriages for the purpose of federal benefits, such as tax and inheritance laws. During the arguments, the justices indicated where they might stand on the issue of whether states can continue to define marriage as a union of a man and a woman, or whether the Constitution provides same-sex couples the right to marry. 4 states, Kentucky, Michigan, Ohio, and Tennessee, brought the cases before the court. A federal appeals court in Ohio upheld the state's bans against same-sex marriage last November. Lawyers for the 4 states argued in a paper given to the Supreme Court that this case is not about the best marriage definition. Lawyer John Birch wrote, "Who decides, the people of each state or the federal courts?" Lawyers for same-sex marriage argue that it comes down to fairness. They also point to the 1967 case of Loving versus Virginia, in which the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the state bans on interracial marriage. The justices said then that those bans violated the constitutional rights of interracial couples. In general, the conservative justices showed their support for the states, and the court's liberal justices indicated their support of gays and lesbians to marry across America. Legal scholars expect the case to end up in a close 5-4 ruling. Some believe the Supreme Court already has shown how it might decide. "I think the writing is on the wall," said Nan Hunter, a Georgetown University law professor. "I think almost everyone believes that it is just a matter of time before gay couples can marry anywhere in the United States." the court is expected to decide later this summer how it will rule on the case.
Thanks to Ann Ball for that report. And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the second part of our education report on learning to read in Sifalaba helps Ghanaian kids learn English. It was not long before the Sifalaba community asked to enlarge the adult program to include children. Ari Sherris is a professor of bilingual education at Texas A&M University in Kingsville, Texas. He began working with the government literacy program in Ghana about 10 years ago. Esther Goody introduced him to Paul Schaefer in 2012, and over the next 2 years, they talked about ways to work together on the school project. In 2014, Mr. Sherris visited the Sifalaba area twice and helped encourage the new movement to teach the Sifalaba language in school. The Mandari Sifalaba chief, Bodua Mango Kafinti II, also supports this effort. He sees the writing of Sifalaba as a way to preserve the language. He says the language helps protect the culture. He says people must become proud of their language to guarantee it continues.
Ari Sherris and Mr. Schaefer together visited a class in northern Ghana. They noticed that some children struggled with English, while others did not. The educators learned that the more successful children attended the night classes with their parents.
In teaching and observing and in some of the classes, we realized that even at sixth grade, the majority were not able to read. But in the third grade, we spent a few days teaching a few alphabet letters and linking them to keywords in their local language. And just within a class period, you could see kids were grasping the whole point of an alphabet that hadn't ever before. You could see what could be done with it if it was done all the time. And there's a sense in which you don't want to claim too much, but there's another sense in which language is very powerful, and the language that you know is something that you can really build on.
Since the Sifalaba language has only recently been written, there are few materials for teachers and students to read.
One thing that's absolutely critical is the whole thing of publishing materials. And even though we live in an era where a lot is done on the internet, I don't think it's practical to have literacy without books. And so our biggest need is to be able to print more books.
Paul Schaefer is happy that donors to the Sifalaba Project recently purchased a copy machine called a duplicator. Having the duplicator in the Sifalaba area makes it possible to do almost all the printing work locally. It will help the Sifalaba community to print books in their own language.
Our vision is that if we can turn it into a small local press, we'll be able to meet their needs for materials and possibly reach out to the other minority languages in the area.
The new duplicator meant that GILLBT could publish a dictionary for beginning readers, the first bilingual dictionary of Sifalaba and English was published in 2014. As their chief hopes, young children in the Sifalaba community can now learn to read and take pride in their language. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm Jim Tedder.
Thank you.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. This week in our series, Bob Doty and I discuss American arts and popular culture during the 1930s. Hard economic times and social conflict have always offered a rich source of material for artists and writers. A painter's colors can show the drying of dreams or the flight of the human spirit. A musician can express the tensions and uncertainty of a people in struggle. The pressures of hard times can be the force to lift a writer's imagination to new heights. So it was during the 1930s in the United States. The severe economic crisis, the Great Depression, created an atmosphere for artistic imagination and creative expression. The common feeling of struggle also led millions of Americans to look to films, radio, and other new art forms for relief from their day-to-day cares.
The most popular sound of the 1930s was a new kind of music, swing music. And the king of swing was a clarinet player named Benny Goodman. Benny Goodman and other musicians made swing music extremely popular during the 1930s. Swing music was a new form of jazz. Many of its first players were black musicians in small, unknown groups. It was only when more well-known white musicians started playing swing music in the middle 1930s that the new music became wildly popular.
One reason for the popularity of swing music was the growing power of radio during the 1930s. Radio had already proven in earlier years that it could be an important force in both politics and popular culture. Millions of Americans bought radios during the 1920s. But radio grew up in the 1930s. Producers became more skillful in creating programs. And actors and actresses began to understand the special needs and power of this new electronic art form. Swing music was not the only kind of music that radio helped make popular. The 1930s also saw increasing popularity for traditional classical music by Beethoven, Bach, and other great musicians. In 1930, the Columbia Broadcasting System began a series of concerts by the New York Philharmonic Orchestra on Sunday afternoons. The next year, the National Broadcasting Company, NBC, began weekly opera concerts.
In 1937, NBC asked Arturo Toscanini of Italy to lead an orchestra on American radio. Toscanini was the greatest orchestra leader of his day. Millions of Americans listened at Christmas time, As Toscanini and the NBC Orchestra began playing the first of 10 special radio concerts. It was a great moment for both music and radio. For the first time, millions of average Americans were able to hear classical music by great musicians as it was being played.
Music was an important reason why millions of Americans gathered to listen to the radio during the 1930s. But even more popular were a series of weekly programs with exciting or funny new actors. Families would come home from school or work and laugh at the foolish experiences of such actors as Jack Benny, Fred Allen, George Burns, Edgar Bergen, and W.C. Fields. Radio helped people forget the hard conditions of the Great Depression, and it helped to bring Americans together and share experiences.
Swing music, classical music, great comedy programs. The 1930s truly were a golden period for radio and mass communications. But it was also during this period that Hollywood and the American film industry became much more skilled and influential. In previous years, films were silent, but the talkies arrived in the 1930s.
Directors could produce films in which actors could talk. Americans reacted by attending film theaters by the millions. It was a great time for Hollywood. The films had exciting new actors. Spencer Tracy, Betty Davis, Katharine Hepburn, the young Shirley Temple. The most famous film of the period was Gone with the Wind, with Clark Gable and Vivian Leigh in the starring roles of Rhett Butler and Scarlett O'Hara.
No, I don't think I will kiss you. Although you need kissing badly. That's what's wrong with you. You should be kissed and often, and by someone who knows how.
Oh, and I suppose you think you are the proper person.
I might be, if the right moment ever came.
Directors in the 1930s also produced such great films as It Happened One Night, Mutiny on the Bounty, and The Life of Emile Zola.
The success of radio and films, as well as the Depression itself, caused problems for many American newspapers during the 1930s. The trouble was not so much that readers stopped buying newspapers. It was that companies talked about their products through advertisements on radio instead of buying advertising space in newspapers. Nearly half of the nation's independently published newspapers either stopped publishing or joined larger companies during the 1930s. By World War II, only 120 cities had competing newspapers.
Weekly and monthly publications faced the same problem as daily newspapers: increased competition from radio and films. Many magazines failed. The two big successes of the period were Life magazine and the Reader's Digest. Life magazine had stories for everyone about film actors, news events, or just daily life in the home or on the farm. Its photographs were the greatest anywhere. Reader's Digest published shorter forms of stories from other magazines and sources.
Most popular books of the period were like the films coming from Hollywood. Writers cared more about helping people forget their troubles than about facing serious social issues. They made more money that way, too. But A number of writers in the 1930s did produce books that were both profitable and of high quality. One was Sinclair Lewis. His book, It Can't Happen Here, warned of the coming dangers of fascism. John Steinbeck's great book, The Grapes of Wrath, helped millions understand and feel in their hearts the troubles faced by poor farmers. Erskine Caldwell wrote about the cruelty of life among poor people in the southeastern United States, and James T. Farrell about life in Chicago.
The same social concern and desire to present life as it really existed also were clear in the work of many American artists during the 1930s. Thomas Benton painted workers and others with strong, tough bodies. Edward Hopper showed the sad streets of American cities. Reginald Marsh painted picture after picture of poor parts of New York City. The federal government created a program that gave jobs to artists. They painted their pictures on the walls of airports, post offices, and schools. The program brought their ideas and creativity to millions of people. At the same time, photography became more important as cameras improved in quality and became more movable. Some photographers, like Margaret Burke White and Walker Evans, used their cameras to report the hard conditions of the Depression.
All this activity in the arts and popular culture played an important part in the lives of Americans during the 1930s. It not only provided relief from their troubles, but expanded their minds and pushed their imaginations. The tensions and troubles of the Great Depression provided a rich atmosphere for artists and others to produce works that were serious, foolish, or just plain fun. And those works, in turn, helped make life a little better as Americans waited, worked, and hoped for times to improve.
Our program was written by David Jarmel. I'm Steve Ember with Bob Doty. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.